Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Matt, how are you going tonight?
I'm doing a lot better than usual, Liam. I'm sipping on my beer.
I did notice that.
Spoilers. I should have left that till the end, shouldn't I?
You know, I was going to leave it to the end, but now a little preamble that just before we hit record, I did notice a nice dark stout there in your glass.
Indeed. We'll revisit that a bit later on. But in answer to your question, I'm very well.
Yeah.
How are you?
Not too bad. You know, that last episode we recorded about you feeling a bit burnt out, I think I'm pretty close to that point of myself at the moment, but it's tough, but getting through the days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something I've learned over the last couple of years is the value of sleep.
Right. And okay. I thought you were going to say, just don't do it. But
just don't do it. Well, absolutely just don't do it. But I've noticed that when I am sort of getting to that point, I really look at my sleep habits and really get back into making sure that I have a good, solid amount of sleep.
Yeah. I can relate to that. I find as I'm getting older, you know, I like to say age is just a number, and I feel the same in my 40s as I did in my 20s, which is true. And then other days I realize that at this age, a night of marginally suboptimal sleep has about the equivalent impact the next day as a night out until like 4 a.m. did, you know, 20
years. Yes, 100%. Absolutely. Completely agree with that. And look, I think you're right. Like I physically feel better and fitter than I did in my 20s easily.
Mm.
But at the same time, I'm at the age now in the 40s where anytime you take off training and take off being active, it quickly adds up.
Mm. All right. Well, are we going to talk about our creaking old bones this evening? Or
No, I don't think so. I don't think people want to hear that.
I don't think they want to hear the creaking, and that's why we're lubricating with these with these beers, right?
That's right. That's right. No, I think you messaged me yesterday sometime about a topic that is kind of near and dear to my heart, right?
Yeah.
12 months ago, I launched a business called N-Cube Solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I deliberately chose that name, Solutions. Funnily enough, I don't know if I've mentioned to anyone at all, I used to toy with the idea of having N-Cubed Labs.
I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Except when I was looking at registering the company name, it kind of raised flags. And I assume if you have the name Labs in your name, you kind of have to justify it. I'm not sure.
Interesting. Yep.
I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, it just didn't seem as straightforward. So I just rejigged it. But I like the idea of Solutions, right? Because the way I want my business to be structured and the way that I am really marketing it and pushing it at the moment is that we solve problems. First and foremost, we're there to solve problems.
Yeah, which is different from labs, right? Which is really about experimenting or R&D.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if people ask me and professionally, what do I do? What's my job or what does the company do? In a roundabout way, yes, we are enterprise developers. I am an enterprise developer. I'm a solution architect, right?
Yeah.
And they ask, well, what does that mean? Because most people outside of our industry actually have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
And so the easiest way that I come down to it, and the thing that I've come to realize over the last couple of years, is my passion doesn't lie in writing software as much as it used to.
Right.
My passion lies in solving problems more than anything.
Yep.
Which is why when you...
What's your job title at N-Cube Solutions?
I call myself the chief problem solver.
Right. Yeah.
I thought, look, I could be the CEO, the CTO, the founder, whatever you want to call it. But I just thought I'd just be a little bit tongue in cheek and play on that solutioning aspect.
Yeah.
And call myself the chief problem solver, because I really want to focus on the fact that we first and foremost solve problems.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, the tools we will use to solve those problems will be software.
Yeah.
Right. And it might even be a very narrow subset of software tools, but it does not have to be.
Yeah.
And so you sent me a message this morning, this afternoon, about a problem that you were recently having.
Yeah.
Which then got you thinking about how you solve those problems.
Yeah. And I actually mentioned something similar to you last week as well. Although unfortunately the context of that has gone. but I do have, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and I've been thinking about how do we solve problems. And I know that you're obviously very interested in solving problems, and that's kind of where your passion lies. I was thinking about a specific quote that Chris said, and I don't want this podcast to turn into a Chris Simon fan podcast, but I do drop his name quite a lot, because that talk that we went to, and that was back in February, it's now August, right?
Yep.
So that was 6 months ago. But that talk that we went to still continually leaves me thinking and rethinking. I'm still getting a lot out of that all the time. Yeah, it's just probably one of the better talks, and it just goes around in my head all the time. In this particular case, I was thinking about something you said, which was there's always a domain solution to a problem, to the problem, mm-hmm. right? And I was thinking about some examples, right? And I was thinking about, I'm currently in the process of reviving an old project. So this was a full stack solution that I built for a pub that wanted a meal ordering solution.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems they had was that they were delivering meals via Uber Eats.
Yep.
And Uber Eats take 35% as a cut. Now, that's very steep, especially when you think of the narrow profit margins of a food business, and you think about the fact that this is not a digital service. This is a physical product with a lot of labor. There's people working in that kitchen, and the overheads, it's a big chunk. It's a really big chunk. In fact, really, people lose money. Like, all of the restaurants that are on Uber Eats are losing money on Uber Eats.
Yeah.
But they have to be on there because their competitors are on there. It's just how it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how Uber have cornered that market. So what these guys wanted, actually initially what they wanted was a reservation system. And I'll come to that because that's the problem bit I'm going to talk about, right? But then we started talking about, well, can we do the food ordering? And, you know, there's no delivery via this app that I created for them, but it was a mobile app that people could download and install, and they could order food and then go and pick it up and pay for it through the app and get a discount.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up building this for them. This was probably about 5 or 6 years ago now, and they didn't use it because they ended up changing the nature of their business. They switched to effectively catering, for want of a different detailed explanation of what actually happened. You know, the kind of live food venue, it didn't really continue. So I've had this thing sitting there, you know, in my repo for years, and I've been thinking more and more over the years about open sourcing it, making it a demo. And I have a lot of plans for this thing, and we'll talk about that more in the future at some point. But anyway, one of the things that I did was an algorithm that I created for working out whether or not someone could make a reservation based on capacity that the restaurant would define, and, you know, whether there are another number of people booking already, whether there was a threshold they needed to retain for walk-ins. And I put a fair bit of effort into that, and I created an algorithm and some logic to manage all of that. And it was completely the wrong thing to do, because do you think they care about overbooking?
Oh, hell no.
Absolutely not.
No.
And it's interesting because they never raised this at the time. I mean, I guess there was a lot going on with them. By the way, the reservation system did go into production, and they did use it for about a year. Mm. It was only the food ordering system that never went into production.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I guess they never had enough bookings to get anywhere near that threshold. I mean, their core business was walk-ins, but they would take reservations. But yeah, they wouldn't have cared about overbooking. It wouldn't, you know, they would have been delighted. And as you know, people that book, there's always a threshold of people that don't show up.
Oh, absolutely. Anecdotally, there is, it's common in the airline industry, and yeah, reservations, hotels, reservations, everything.
Yeah.
You're better off overbooking than underbooking.
I don't know if you're better off, but that is certainly what they do. I don't know if we as the customers are better off, but.
Well, no, but as you said, as you sort of alluded to before, when the comment or the quote that there's always a domain solution.
That's it. That's
right. And when I've heard this mentioned before, it's like if a hotel overbooks,
yeah,
and on the odd chance every single person shows up, because, you know, they've got the data, they know what percentage they can expect to have show up.
Yes.
So they roughly know what's a safe level amount to overbook. And in the odd chance where they get that wrong, I've heard, you know, they just have deals with the hotel next door.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You small compensation for the customer, everyone's happy, everyone wins.
Exactly. Yeah. Airlines, they overbook. It's like, oh, sorry, we'll put you on the next flight and we'll give you a discount on your, you know, or depending on which airline. Yeah, sometimes they give you a free voucher and they put you on the next flight, put you in a hotel. Yeah, a hotel, they'll do deals with the hotel next door, plus comp the customer. This particular pub, you know, it was never going to actually be a problem of them overbooking and having all these walk-ins and not having room for people. But if that were ever to be the case, they would find a solution. So they would get outside the restaurant area in the pub. They would find some tables. They'd figure it out. That, you know, that's not our problem as software developers to solve.
So really, you fell for the trap of all the rookies in the industry, right?
Go on.
You're familiar with the term Yagni?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like you've gone ahead, anticipated something, and put in a shitload of extra work and effort and logic and complexity to mitigate it around a scenario that either A, never eventuated,
yeah,
or B, you just ain't never going to need it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Look, as it happens, this was kind of part of the requirements that we discussed at the time, but that's neither here nor there. You're absolutely right. You know, the point is I shouldn't have put that work in because nobody cares. It wasn't a problem. And it was, you know, if it ever were to be a problem, in fact, sorry, just to loop back to this particular business, there were certain occasions where they would fill up and sell out and they would close down the venue and say, sorry, no walk-ins, but that would be planned events. And when they were planning events, they would sell tickets and they would, you know, this wasn't reservations for a table. This was tickets. And there would be, okay, there's 40 tickets or 60 tickets or 150 tickets, however many, depending on whether they were closing the whole venue for this event or part of it or what have you. But other than those specific circumstances, they're never going to turn away people, whether they're booked walk-ins, what have you. You know, they're going to find room. So there was no need to create an algorithm to detect whether there was room for people to book during this time or not. Now, I think the reason behind this particular piece of work was that I was going to say they wanted, but no, it was me. I wanted to. I wanted to show on a calendar the availability. I wanted people to be able to sort of see on a calendar whether there was room for them to book at the time they wanted to or not. Mm-hmm. But it was unnecessary. And I don't think I ever built that feature anyway. You know, it's domain.
The budget dried up because of your anti-overbooking implementation.
Right. Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, the budget, in fact, for this particular client was burgers.
Yep.
So I was working for burgers. Beer and burgers for this particular client. So yes, but it got me thinking. And I'll tell you another, I'll give you another example. Just going back to thinking about this comment from Chris about there's always a domain solution. This past week, I was working on a spec review for a client. I was working with some colleagues and we were designing and architecting a solution for a client that had some fairly complex requirements. And the complexity was somewhat in the domain, but more around the integrations.
Yep.
So this particular client wanted to use an existing software solution that's tailored to their domain, but they wanted us to wrap some infrastructure and some various integrations and interactions around it.
Yep.
To allow people to interact with it in a way that it doesn't currently support and is not likely to support in the foreseeable future.
Yep.
So we started working on this. And as we're working through it and we're doing all kinds of things and we're designing the solution, we came to this one particular problem and we're saying, okay, so in this particular module, we need to update our copy of the data if this data changes in the record system that the client is using, the COSS solution that they're already using. And we also need to change the record in the COSS solution if it gets changed in the thing that we're going to build.
Yep.
Okay. Now what happens if someone comes along, uses the system that we're building, and they create a record and there's a conflict with what's in the COSS solution? So it's not about having data that matches and then changing it, but it's what if they create new data and that data doesn't match what's in there? And we probably spent 45 minutes debating this and figuring out how we were going to design the conflict resolution around this particular piece of domain knowledge and this particular piece of data and these entity relationships. And after about 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes, I just said, why are we wasting time on this? Mm-hmm. This is not a technical problem. The client will tell us how we solve that situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all it came down to is, you know, if we don't need to figure out what to do about this. We need to ask the client what they want us to do in this situation.
Yep, absolutely. This exact scenario, I've got a few things on this, right? A client that I have done work for in the past, you're familiar with them. They wanted the solution they were proposing was kind of like, well, that they needed, and I'll come back to that point too. I've just remembered something too, but something they needed ended up being kind of like a spreadsheet style input situation. And we were trying to figure it out. Not quite. Not quite, because, you know, data grids have, you got headers and like kind of sorted.
All right, I'll withdraw my glib comment as you were.
But we were trying to come up with this really as fancy solution as we could, trying to make it, how easy can we make it? Like, what's the way we can reduce the number of clicks for the users to get what they need, be able to minimize the amount of errors that they put in place. And again, we spent like maybe a day or so trying to figure out what this optimal UI would be. And then I had the exact same epiphany you had. And I just like the client presented the problem to us in a spreadsheet. We just need to tweak that interaction ever so slightly to make sure that they can't make the errors that they don't want to make, that we need to protect them from, and maybe present the data a little bit better. But why are we going out of our way to come up with this fancy UI when the client's already working in a certain space? They've already got their head in a certain space and they kind of know it, but let's just guide them that little bit further.
Yeah.
And in the end, you know, it's an extra half a day's worth of work.
Yeah.
You know, we spent 1.5 days, 2 days doing it, but we took 1.5 days to figure out what the ideal solution is.
Yeah.
And then a half a day to actually get there, which is effectively what you're talking about there. But
it's interesting. I don't think I could ever possibly fathom out which client this could be.
So the other part of this, I've got a couple of bookmarks that I keep coming back to, right? Are you familiar with the works of Udi Dahan from Particular Software?
No.
So he's the author of End Service Bus.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Extremely smart guy, especially around distributed computing.
Yeah.
And he goes through and teases apart these exact scenarios, right? Maybe from, like, I've seen examples where he might use, say, Ticketek or the Amazon website.
Yeah.
Right? And talking about eventual consistency versus immediate consistency and these kind of concepts. And sort of talking about, and this, again, this goes back to what Chris's talk, right? If I go to buy a product from Amazon and it's not in stock, you know, in a monolithic application, there's one value of stock. I go to buy it. I can decrement that account because we're all in one monolithic application. It's very sequential work.
Yeah.
Now, once it becomes distributed and my warehousing service, I've got a warehousing service, I've got a product service, I've got my shopping cart service, and I've got all these other services around, and I go to make my purchase and I create my order, and then I go and put in my credit card details, and then it sends off that message to say, okay, I've made my order.
Yeah.
At which point do we then start looking at, okay, is there enough stock left? Because when I first click the button, there might have been, but when the order was getting processed, even the point where I've put my credit card details in and click submit, someone else might have come in and taken that last order.
Yeah.
And his argument there is, well, so what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes, you could go through and put all these extra checks and do everything else in your or extra complexity in your logic to handle these. But in reality, if you take a step back and you look at it from the domain point of view,
yeah,
so what?
Yeah.
Send an email to the customer saying, oh, we're out.
Yeah.
It's going to be a 2-week delay. Would you like a refund?
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about it, if you do an order for any store, right, especially the supermarkets, I don't know if you do any online ordering with supermarkets, but any store, you know, you put in your order, yes, they show a stock level, they show availability, and, you know, they're not making it up. Like you said, it's eventual consistency, right? So if there's 3 items left in stock and 4 people go to order it at the same time, one of them's not going to get it, but then the 5th person is going to see no stock available. That's fine. They deal with it. And if you think about it, we put all this effort into the technology solution and we think about, no, we want to make sure we show everyone the right stock levels and blah, blah, blah. But before we had computers, those companies would take those orders by fax or by post or by phone or whatever. And they'd write it down. The stock level was not an order problem. It was a fulfillment problem.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. You know, that gets pushed off down to the chain. Then if there's a fulfillment problem, yes, you contact the customer and you say, okay, there's not this item available. There's been an error, what have you. Do you want to wait? The next one will be available a day later now, if it's Amazon, you know, or 2 weeks, like you said, or would you like a refund? Yeah, absolutely. That's how you handle it. Let the business deal with that situation. It's not a technology problem.
Yeah.
And in fact, even like when you talk about microservices and when you talk about bounded context, it's not an ordering problem. It's a fulfillment problem.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. So I sort of caught myself when I was talking about this previous client that I did work for, where they presented me with effectively a solution.
Yeah.
Now, I sort of chuckled to myself because when you were talking about the quote from Chris, I was actually thinking along the lines of something that has stuck with me for ever since talking to him, when I threw out the term requirements to him.
Yeah.
And he pulled me up pretty much straight away. And he's like, yeah, I've got sort of this, you know, requirements is a quirky word.
Yeah.
Because usually when customers come to you with requirements, they come to you with a solution.
Yeah.
Right. And if they're coming to me with a solution, then what is my job?
Yeah.
And really, since around that point, I really like to reframe things that come across my Kanban board or my desk or whatever you want to call it, my inbox, in that space. And I really like to try and figure out, okay, well, what is the actual problem here?
Mm.
Are these problems or are these requirements? Are these solutions that are getting pushed on me?
Yeah.
Because if they're solutions, I need to start pushing back and start asking questions.
Yeah.
Right. And this comes down to what we were talking, sort of the root of this conversation is about problem solving.
Yeah.
If people come to me, and I think I've mentioned in the past, current client of mine, where we needed to unlock a specific system because the overnight task was running too long and it has to unlock in the morning, but through external circumstances, they needed that to be reduced significantly.
Yeah.
So they came to us with a solution by saying, well, we don't need to lock the entire database. Can we just update the lock so that it reduces the scope of them? Can we change this and that, whatever else? I'm like, yes, you can provide me with those requirements, but if I take into account what your actual request is, what your problem is, and I can look at the rest of the landscape right now with where we're at, the resourcing we have, the skills we have, the time we have, I can't give you the solution you're asking for.
Mm.
But because I understand your problem, I can find another solution that will work.
Mm.
And we were able to do that. And we were able to solve that problem for them in that immediate need for that short term that they just absolutely needed.
Mm.
And we did not miss a beat. But had we have gone with the original suggestion, the original requirements in quotes, we would have completely missed the deadlines.
Mm.
By missing the deadlines, the business would not have been able to get the value that they needed to at that critical moment.
Yeah.
No, it's not a long-term fix. And when we presented the solution, we went to the business and said, you guys are making the decision. I'm giving you all the data. This is my recommended approach. And this is how we're going to solve the problem for your short-term needs. Absolutely. Down the track, we'll look at the long-term. But right now, just to get the pressure off, let's look at these short-term solutions. And then they weighed it up and they decided, okay, well, that's clearly a short-term solution for them to just get through that bottleneck.
Mm.
So, yeah, I just don't want to harp too much on about that, but that idea has really resonated with me by rethinking that term requirements.
Yeah, I want to give you one more example, actually, and I'm going to focus on that term requirements because I think it's interesting. And this is actually the one I sent you earlier. And then I want to, unless you have more notes, I want to change tack a little bit and talk more about problem solving. But this is the example I messaged you about today because I think it's interesting. So, actually, quick tangent, bit of news. So I've been speaking over the past, I don't know, 10 episodes or something, maybe more. I've mentioned in passing hints about a little side project I've been working on.
Yes.
Yeah. So a quick update on that. So the side project is an Outlook add-in.
Yep.
And I am currently in the process of publishing it via Azure. And I'm doing it. There's two bits that I have to publish. One is the Outlook add-in itself, which gets published onto AppSource, which is now the Microsoft 365 marketplace. Oh, that's still AppSource. And the update on that is that listing is live. It's approved. It's awesome. On there. Yeah.
Didn't you say you're having issues getting that approved?
I was having issues getting that approved. Yes.
That's all sorted.
By and large, yes. I had some issues getting that published. Oh, unless you're talking about different issues.
Oh, just the ones we spoke about last, where they were rejecting you because you didn't add value.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I solved that problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. You found a problem to solve.
Yeah. When they say not adding value, it's a tick box exercise, right, on their checklist.
Yeah.
So I added value in the way that they wanted me to. And that got through that. There were some other problems as well, particularly around some issues with the Office SDK itself, which I have worked around by disabling the feature in the environment in which it currently doesn't work. And there were some other issues with the listing that I had to fix as well. That's all done and it's approved and it's live. But the backend component, and that's free, by the way, so that add-in is, that's not where I monetize it. The add-in doesn't work unless you've got an account for the backend. And the backend, I'm trying to launch on the Azure SaaS marketplace.
Yep.
And that is the bit that is still waiting to be approved. And one of the reasons that I wasn't able to publish that was because I had some feedback from someone at Microsoft who's kind of assigned to me to get this thing published. And he said I needed to change. So the way that it worked, right, is you could log into this backend portal without a license. So you just need a Microsoft account. You can log in, you can poke around, but you can't do anything with it unless you get the license.
Yep.
And I was kind of okay with that. I thought, yep, you can do everything except, you know, the value that it adds is via the Outlook add-in, ironically. That's the actual thing that does the work.
and you can't use that without a license.
Yep.
And he said, look, that is technically fine, but you shouldn't do it because it's extra load on your system, which if that's a problem you come across, that's a nice problem to have. But it's just kind of, for whatever reason, it's not the right thing to do. People that don't have a license should just not have access to anything.
Yep.
So I said, okay, well, that kind of aligns with some items I had on the backlog anyway, that I just deprioritized. So the way that you sign up for the license and activate the system is you have to go and create your account, and then you have to go and register your company, and then you go and do the licensing and blah, 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 blah. And I really wanted to streamline all that through Wizards, which I've now done. And that means that all these other pages just don't exist. So you can only get to, you can log in and just get to the homepage, but you can't get anywhere else without going through these wizards, and you can't get through these wizards without a license activation token. So that kind of kills a few birds with one stone. But I came across this interesting problem today, right? And the problem that I had today was that to get to various parts of this app, you have to have a license assigned. But then I didn't want people to have a license just to manage their company licenses through the portal. Because in my mind, I was thinking, you might have someone who is an admin, right? They might be the office manager if it's a small business. They might be the sysadmin if you've got a support team. They don't have a they don't need a license because they're never going to use the Outlook add-in. So I didn't want them to have a license just to get access to the portal to manage this stuff. So it was a role that I created, which is a company admin role. So there are certain pages in the app that if you have a license assigned, or if you're a company admin, you should be able to get to this page. So here's the problem, right? How much do you know about ASP.NET Core authorization policies? I don't want to go too technical here, but just wondering how much you know about this stuff.
It's been a while since I've polished up on them.
Okay. So you can define a policy, and a policy effectively is an arbitrary piece of code that you execute, and you have a context that's passed into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, the context is not succeeded by default. So you can either manually set the context to succeed or fail or do nothing, and it will fail that requirement.
Yep.
Now, I have got a policy defined for has license, and I've got another policy defined for is company admin. And the reason I have that is because I'm not using ASP.NET Core Identity, so I can't just use roles because I'm not using roles in that way. I'm doing it in an arbitrary way, which aligns better with the rest of my domain and what have you. Now, with roles, when you use an authorize attribute, which you can put on your controller, mm-hmm. if you're in controllers, or you can put on your page if you're using Blazor, which I am in the portal, the add-in uses Angular, the portal is Blazor.
Yep.
So I had this issue where I needed to have two policies, right? So I wanted the policy to be has license or is company admin.
Yep.
But you can't do that with policies. So I don't know if you remember with roles, with the old ASP.NET Core Identity roles, you could have authorized roles equals and put a comma separated yes. the roles, and it would or those.
Yep.
Or you could put separate lists of
separate attributes
and it would and those.
Yep.
So that's how you could control that. But you can't do that with policies. So I spent a lot of time reading up on it, and I was thinking, okay, there's a number of different ways I can approach this. One way is I can create a new policy that is company admin or has license. And I just thought that's very messy and inelegant because it's a very specific policy for one very specific page, which means it's not actually a policy at all, really.
Yeah.
It's a requirement for one page. So I didn't like that. And I thought, well, what I can do is I can write a custom attribute and a custom handler and some conventions that would allow me to, I was going to call it an authorize any attribute and then have a bunch of different policies and pass them and figuring it out that way. And then I started going nuts and thinking I can release this as a NuGet package and all that. And then I don't know how much time I spent on this, right? But I just thought, this is absurd. There must be a better way. And I realized that there is, because I went back to the requirements, right? I went back to the client, which is me.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, really, I guess Megan is the product owner because it's kind of her idea. But I went back to the client, which is also me. So I guess I took off my developer hat and I put back on my client hat. And I said, what is the requirement? And I said, well, the requirement is that the user has to have a license or be a company admin.
Yep.
Now, this particular handler is in the portal. This isn't shared with the backend. So this isn't anything that controls whether or not they can use the add-in. This is just about accessing pages within the app that you have to have a license to access, but you don't have to have a license to access any of these pages if you're a company admin. There are certain things where the reverse is true, where you do have to be a company admin. Doesn't matter whether you have a license or not, but you have to explicitly be a company admin. So that's separate. So I just went back to the requirement and I realized that for all these pages where you have to have a license, if you're an admin, you don't have to have a license. So I just went back into the policy that's the has license policy. And if the user is an admin, a company admin, I just succeed that policy.
So your has license is effectively has license or is admin.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. For that particular, within that scope.
Yeah.
So like not in the, so in the back end. So there, in fact, there's two APIs because there's an API for the portal and another one for the add-in. So in the API for the add-in, that would not work because well, in fact, there's no concept of a company admin in the add-in at all in the API for the add-in. But, you know, if someone's a company admin, it doesn't matter. They still need a license to be able to use the add-in. So it wouldn't work there. It's not a universal solution, but it's also not a universal problem. It's a problem that's very limited in scope. And within that limited scope, the requirement states that people should be able to access these pages if they're a company admin or if they have a license. So yeah, it's a simple solution.
Yeah. And you've saved yourself a whole heap of headaches.
I have, indeed.
Because you could go down writing the ord policy handler or the anded policy handler or whatever you wanted to do, or build all those out with all the unit tests and all the testing and everything else that goes around that, handling all the edge cases and dealing with all that.
Yeah.
Or, as you said, you go back to the product owner, clarify your requirements. Are they hard and fast rules? Are they hard and fast requirements? Can we really look at them properly and figure out what that domain solution is that saves everyone a lot of headaches?
Yep. Yeah.
Now, interestingly, I'm trying to see if I can segue this in any way whatsoever. Now, I think it could have been earlier this year or it would have been late last year. Scott Hanselman did a talk and there's a video somewhere, I'll need to dig it up, about problem solving.
Yeah.
And also sort of tied into it was this idea about, I guess, gatekeeping within the industry and how much do we actually need to know about what the computers are doing or how software runs or how an operating system works, how the .NET CLR interprets the IL and converts that into machine language that then gets converted, et cetera, right? How much do we actually need to know about these things? And the example he gave in this talk was if your toaster breaks down, if your toaster stops working, how do you troubleshoot it? How do you go, what do you do to problem solve that?
I normally stick a knife into the toaster.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, are you expected to get the multimeter out and know exactly how the inner workings of a toaster are? No. You know, some people might, and that's great, and they might be able to do it. But he goes through the audience, and, you know, he's just asking people. It's like, okay, well, what would your steps for troubleshooting the toaster be? Is there something else on the same outlet circuit? Does that work? Does the kettle work? Because, you know, you can see the flowchart starting to build out, right? Does the kettle work? If no, check the lights. Does the house have power? If no, ask your neighbors, do they have power? Right? Is it an outage on the street? Right? And just basically being able to just take it that one step further. And not just looking at, okay, well, the problem here could be our toaster's not working, but that's a symptom or a requirement, so to speak. Fix the toaster is the requirement. But if you don't actually, if you take that at face value, you might end up pulling apart your toaster trying to find out why it's not working.
It's almost like a variation on the five whys.
Yeah, almost. But it's being able to get down and dig into it. But then another example he gave in this, and it's been a while since I've seen this video, so this might be a bit sort of sporadic, but the other example he gave was teaching his son how to drive.
Right.
Right. Now, to learn how to drive, do you need to know how the internal combustion engine works?
No.
Arguably, no. Do you need to know how the gearbox works, how an automatic or a manual gearbox works, or how the clutch works? If you're learning to drive a manual, do you need to know how the clutch works and how the gears shift and everything else inside the gears?
You need to understand the interface.
Yeah. Well, arguably, you could learn to drive without understanding that. But if you want to become a racing driver, and if you want to become a professional driver and you want to, you know, be very efficient with your driving and you want to be an expert driver, absolutely, you need to start to know these extra levels of details.
Sorry, when I say understand the interface, I mean you need to learn the UI of a car.
Oh, the car, absolutely. You need to know the pedals. You need to know the difference between two pedals and three pedals and a gear stick versus a selector or a shifter versus the selector, right? Yes, you need to know that. But if you want to become proficient in the industry, if you want to become a racing driver, and if you want to start optimizing your lap times, you probably want to know a bit more about how your gearbox works and your gear ratios, how the clutch interacts.
Right.
And you do start to need to learn it, want to learn a bit more. And it might get to a point where, yeah, you want to start learning about the pistons and the conrods and the crankshaft and all those things internal, but you don't have to, is his point.
Yeah.
To get in a car, to, you know, put your foot on the brake, turn the key or push the start button these days and get going, you don't need to know these things. And his argument's the same with technology, right?
Yeah.
To start programming, no, you don't need to know a lot of how your C-sharp code gets compiled into IL that's then runs on the CLR, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the more you know and the more you want to dig in, the more it will serve you down the track. And, you know, like, we're blessed these days, right? This machine I'm recording here on, I can't remember, it's either 32 gig or 64 gig of RAM, right? But when I was at school and you're talking, you've only got, I think, 64 meg or 100K.
Sorry? 64K.
No, I think, well, that was back in the Commodore days, right? I'm thinking when I was actually using the 486 and the Pentiums, but still.
So my Pentium had, I think, 16 meg.
Yeah.
And that was actually, like,
yeah, it was about 1632s. Anyway, but right, where memory is extremely limited.
Yeah.
You need to be conscious. Am I going to use an int or am I going to use a short?
Oh, yeah. Look, we don't care about optimization and performance anymore. The fact that, I mean, look at how we build UIs. Look at the sheer amount of data that we pump into the browser just to even render an application.
Oh, yeah. Like, the amount of divs that go through that do absolutely nothing.
I'm not even talking about those. I'm talking about frameworks.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
The minified CSS and JavaScript files that we pump in, like, you know, the WASM, you know, files, like the amount of data that we just send to the browser just to even the, you know, an interim runtime to put the application on. It's
But I guess my point of this rant is we these days don't need to go to that depth, right? I don't need to now know how the gearbox in my 2017, 2018 car works.
Yeah.
But if I do, I can fix it myself. I could probably optimize it if I wanted to. I could make it faster if I wanted to.
There's another
way. We have the benefit now that we don't need to, but if you want to, you can, and you can eke out a lot more performance and a lot more. We can do a lot more with what we have.
There's another way of looking at that, which goes back to what we were saying before. So you said, if you want to, you can. More to the point, if you need to, you can. So if you think back to everything else that we were talking about before, and the common, that catchphrase, which is, who said this, that premature optimization is the root of all evil? It's a famous quote.
It's a famous quote, but it's also often misquoted.
Right. Did I misquote it?
No, it's, well, that's the common misquotation. The saying premature optimization is the root of all evil is attributed to Donald Knuth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Knuth.
Knuth. So according to wikiquote.org, the real problem is that programmers have spent far too much time worrying about efficiency in the wrong places and at the wrong times.
Yeah.
Premature optimization is the root of all evil. And then in brackets, the part that always gets left out, or at least most of it in programming.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I think it's also the part before it, right? Efficiency is in the wrong places and at the wrong times.
Yes, exactly. And this goes back to what we were talking about before, right? Which is certainly 20, 30 years ago, yes, you had to make sure that you were coding efficiently. And, you know, we certainly didn't have a garbage collector. And yes, you needed to think about, do I use an int or a short or what have you? And all these different things, you know, you had to define the length of your arrays, you know, you didn't have lists, all these kind of different things. You know, you had to be very conscious of that. And now, as I just said, we don't give a shit about any of that. We're pumping like megabytes worth of data into a browser before we even render anything.
Absolutely.
Right? So my point being that, who cares? It doesn't matter. We have, as you said, like Scott Hanselman said, we have the luxury of not caring about any of that anymore. So don't worry about it. And again, like you said earlier, Yagni, and what you were saying was, you know, yes, if you know more about those things, if you want to, you can learn them and, you know, you can, that might make you more efficient. But unless you're doing that in your own time out of pure joy, chances are you're wasting your time learning that stuff, because you can learn that if you hit a performance bottleneck and you hit some kind of issue that makes you think, okay, now I need to optimize this. I need to find out where my problem is and I need to fix it. Maybe you have a requirement at that point to learn more about that particular topic. Now, that's not to say you don't need some broad fundamentals, because of course you do. And that's not...
I was going to say, you might see sort of my face contorting a bit there, because I remember many years back working with a junior who was doing his Masters of IT, right? So post-grad. And I had to school him in how Boolean math worked and how the flag types enums actually worked. And
I'm not saying that you don't need to have good fundamentals and broad fundamentals, but you don't need to become a specialist in every single thing.
Yes. Oh no, that I agree. Right. And I completely agree with this. Sorry?
And nor can you.
No, absolutely not. And like the example I just said, sort of, if I'm oring two flags together, obviously we know that it could be one of the, as you mentioned with your policies, right?
Yeah.
Now, I took this for granted. Obviously, it's not something that was taught in that university course that this guy went through, but like this is stuff I learned way back in high school that I've just carried through since then, right? I remember I think it was year 10, maybe year 11, our computing teacher teaching us just binary arithmetic and how binary numbers were written. I had a fellow student, one of these completely random standout people that you're just lucky to know kind of deal, who for his year 12 computing assignment decided he wanted to write a 3D game engine in assembler.
Okay, right.
Which he did. Like, he actually did it. It wasn't just a pie in the sky kind of dreaming. He actually did it. But he taught our computing class assembly language for a couple of lessons. The teacher just said, here you go, off you go and do it. I think the teacher wanted to learn stuff about it.
Yeah.
Right. To this day, that still sticks in my head. And, you know, do I use it? Probably not. But it's handy to know.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know if you've seen too, there's people on YouTube who have series and series of videos about creating computers from first principles.
Yes. Yes. I have seen those.
They start with the very basics. They build a transistor, then they turn the transistor into OR gates, and they build the OR gates into NAND switches and whatnot, and they just build them all up, and they end up with these working computers.
Yeah.
And it's insane.
Yeah.
Right? I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of knowledge and there's a lot of value in that knowledge, but again, it is absolutely not needed.
Yeah.
Sorry, interesting. I'm just reading more on this premature optimization quote. Right. Programmers waste enormous amounts of time thinking about or worrying about the speed of non-critical parts of their programs. And these attempts at efficiencies actually have a strong negative impact when debugging and maintenance are considered.
Yep.
We should forget about small efficiencies. Say about 97% of the time, premature optimization is the root of all evil. Yet we should not pass up our opportunities in that critical 3%, right? And that's why this quote is often misquoted.
Yeah.
It's often used as a catch-all, we're not going to worry about optimization because premature optimization is the root of all evil.
Yep.
Whereas what it's actually saying is optimization in the wrong places adds complexity.
Yep.
And adds no value.
Yep.
Okay. Well, that's my interpretation of it. Anyway, so that's just a little sidetrack. Right.
And I think more to the point, it's about being a distraction from optimization in the right place.
Yeah.
And if you think back to things that we've been speaking about this evening, the term that we've thrown about a few times and we haven't really dived into is edge cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've spoken about a few times about all the effort that you put into these what ifs and these edge cases, and it's probably not, well, it's more often than not required. Like with the example that I gave around this reservation system. Okay, on the off chance that one day maybe they get booked out, or okay, we'll deal with that then, that's just not something you need to put the time and effort into engineering for, because the ROI doesn't warrant it, especially given that there will be a domain non-technology solution to the problem at the time anyway.
That, you know, does not impede the rest. And it's not just an RO, like it's not just how much extra effort does it take to build that feature.
Yeah.
It's how much extra complexity does it add to your software, to your solution space?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, there's the opportunity cost. And then there's the, as you said, what's the impact on the maintainability of the solution? And then there's the opportunity cost to them as a business as well. I mean, well, that's a separate, that's more around the suitability of the solution and the, you know, the realisticness of the problem. You know, do you want to turn people away? No. The same thing with the example that Chris gave in his talk, which was about overbooking seats for a course, right? Yeah. That's the example he was giving. It's, you know, and I think it may even have been me, but maybe not, when someone put their hand up and said, well, what do you do if you run out of space in the room then? And he said, find another room, like run it twice. You know, that's not our problem.
And it's interesting too, because if you actually think about the overbooking argument that you've just had there, right? That whole problem, from a business perspective, it actually makes more sense not to have it. Now, hear me out, right? If you're the user of the application and you want to book dinner tonight and it says it's not booked in, it's already booked out.
Yeah.
How do I know how many people have just glossed over that could have wanted to come in?
You don't. Yeah.
You know how many people, you might be able to get metrics to say so many people looked at availabilities this night, but you actually don't know. And I think this is what you're referring to, opportunity cost, right? You don't know what reservations have just walked past, effectively just walked past your front door.
Yeah.
Whereas if people were to walk in and then they were to say, okay, you know, do you have a reservation? Do you have a table? Oh no, sorry, we're booked out now. We're overbooked. You can count how many people you actually turn away.
Yeah.
So they'd get a better understanding of their demand.
You know what else? Do you know how many times I've walked into a restaurant and I've said, do you have a table? And they've looked around at all the tables that have got a reserved sign on them, taken one of the reserved signs off the table and said, yeah, sure, here you go, sit down.
Oh yeah, but it's not just that. I've also had if you can be in and out in the next hour or 45 minutes, yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's when we look at them and say, if you can service in that time, we can be out in that time.
Yeah. And that's when they say, well, if you can order in.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
So
I'm familiar with that dance.
I think you're right. Like I think it's one of those things, without really spending too much time on it, that idea of edge cases, you'll probably find the majority of the time, edge cases can be handled in a non-technical solution.
I agree. And I think not only can edge cases be handled in a non-technical solution, but if edge cases are happening frequently enough that you need to accommodate them, then they're not edge cases.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't worry about edge cases, I guess. But I mean, I just want to loop back to, again, it being a domain solution, because where I wanted to go with this, right, what I wanted to ask you and what I've kind of been leading up to is about, well, how do you solve complex problems, right?
Domain-driven design.
Well, exactly, right?
What's the subtitle of the book? Tackling Complexity in the Heart of Software. There you go.
All right. But here's the thing, is that's actually right. Because if you think about it this way, well, in fact, let me just take it a step back. If I think about all of the complex problems that I've solved, the more I think about it, the more I realize there are very, very few complex problems, really. Only complex understandings of them. Because if I park software for a moment and I think about everything that I've ever dealt with in my life, organizational, personal, software, technical, what have you, all of these complex problems, when you get to the heart of them, you don't ever come up with a complex solution. Maybe that's not true. Maybe sometimes you do, but you rarely come up with a complex solution to a complex problem. What you more often than not do is make a complex problem simple. Because if a problem is complex, it's more likely than not that that is a sign that you just haven't understood it.
Yes, I agree. And sorry, I was just looking up a few things because this is just now a whole heap, another train of thought.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get my head back around something that's been mentioned to me in the past, and that is about the difference between complexity or complex problems and complicated problems.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? And that people often conflate the two.
Yeah.
But they're not actually equal. I'm trying to get the diagrams that I'm thinking of.
Is this kind of what I've been saying in a way? I'm trying to think.
To an extent.
Versus complex.
And you'd need to go into the actual terminology, right? But they're very similar words, but they actually do mean different things. In systems theory, complex is a term that is used to refer to the level of components. Okay, I'm not going to go into it right now. But yes, apparently there is. I'd love to have been able to come up with a lot more a cohesive argument there. But then I think on top of all of that, right? So I think you're right. Complexity is not necessarily in the problems. The complexity is in the solutions.
I would say there may be even a step in the middle between those two things, which is that the complexity is in our understanding of the problem.
Or lack of. We build complex solutions because we have a lack of understanding.
Yes, yeah.
That would be my argument.
That's kind of, yes, I think that's what I was trying to say, yes.
That would be, yeah. And I think you're right. And I like to fall under that. But back to one of the original questions here, right, about problem solving.
Mm.
And this idea that, you know, product owners or end users come to us with requirements, which are often solutions masked as requirements. Now, I'm really, like I said, it's one of these things that have, you know, I've been doing this for the last 20 plus years, and it's only just starting to materialize and crystallize in my head, but really sort of having a defined problem space and solution space in my head, and having sort of two buckets, and making sure that when you have those in quotes requirements coming in, filtering them and making sure and asking the appropriate questions to make sure that they land on the solution, the problem space, make sure that they help define your problem.
Mm. So here's a question then.
Yeah.
If you're asking the question, if my clients are coming to me with the solution, then what's my job? So you're saying your job is to take the problem that they give you and identify the solution. How does that reconcile with what we're saying about the solution should be a domain solution?
Well, that's just it, right? That's the skills and the value we can add, is to tease apart and to really focus on the domain, right? And to be able to work with the stakeholders to identify what the problem in their domain is, or in their domain language is, right? And really start to work with them, to get them to start thinking in that, I guess, domain-driven design mentality, so that they're not just coming to you with solutions, like, or coming to you with overarching solutions covering the end-to-end of their business.
Mm.
We can then start, okay, well, here's the solution you want. You want us to build you an application that does X, Y, and Z, or, you know, does the process from start to finish. One of the common examples that they use in the DDD world is the e-commerce domain.
Of course. Right.
Someone comes here, I want you to build me an online store.
Yeah.
And, you know, here are the solutions. You need to be able to take credit cards, and you need to be able to have it shipping, and we need all these shipping options.
Right.
And I need all these products. It needs this, this, and this. Again, that's putting the solution first.
Yeah.
Because that's what they want. But if we start to then work with them to figure out what those actual requirements are from the domain-driven design space, from the actual problem space, we can start looking at it. Okay, well, you know, problem one, you need to be able, the users need to be able to search for products, as opposed to I need to be able to list all my products on the screen,
mm-hmm.
right? So now you're thinking about the users. What are the users going to be able to do? We're starting to identify the domain concepts and products and users.
Customers.
And customers, yeah. And then we start teasing it out that way. And then, okay, well, we need to be able to add them to a shopping cart. And why do we use shopping cart? Because it's a domain term that we used in the bricks and mortar space.
Mm.
It's not something that e-commerce websites dreamed up.
Yeah. So what you're actually doing here, Liam, is coaching. It's a coaching activity. It's a coaching exercise. And I guess leading a client through this domain-driven design process, it's a coaching, as a skill, it's a form of coaching, really.
Absolutely. And because, well, one, because you want to get the best product for them at the end of the day.
Mm.
But realistically, you could look at it from a very selfish perspective. If I can coach them in that manner, that they end up writing better requirements, easier to read requirements, not complex, not complicated ones that have all these fancy rules, not requirements that are proposing solutions that, you know, if I'm going through my definition of done and I have to hit all the acceptance criteria and all of these things, if you come to me with if the Jira ticket I pick up is solution first, there is a very strict set of acceptance criteria that I have to hit.
Mm, yeah.
Because my implementation has to hit your exact solution. Now, this is going back to the waterfall approach. What happens if the solution you provided to start with missed the mark?
Yeah.
I don't have leeway to fix the problem or actual problem that you're after. But if I can coach the user or the product owner in a way to be problem first and to write better tickets and better requirements, then all of a sudden their tickets are cleaner, they're easier to implement. Acceptance criteria, although it's not as strict, it's still more comprehensive.
Yeah.
Because it's about you solving their problem.
Yeah.
And I can write unit tests that prove that the problem is solved, which again are a lot more comprehensive than the unit tests that I write that says, I have implemented your solution.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is about coaching the business users or the business that we're working with about how we work, but it's also about how they think about their problems.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, which is what you're doing when you're coaching, is getting them to think about that.
Yeah.
But from the angle that you want to, I mean, I guess you're not telling them what the angle is, you're guiding them to come to it themselves, which is, I guess, again, kind of the heart of what coaching is, right?
Yeah. But, and that's
interesting.
It's more agile, obviously, than a waterfall approach or the requirements, but like the requirements gathering. Let's put the solution first and then just build it. Mm. And honestly, if you're heading down that path, that's the world that ChatGPT is just going to be able to just, you could outsource it to ChatGPT or to anywhere else and get the job done.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're presenting them with the solutions. Write me a program that adds A plus B.
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to going in and actually saying, okay, well, we have this problem. We got these problems. Now let's figure out what's actually going wrong and let's find the appropriate solution given the rest of the ecosystem we're dealing with, because these things are, every business is unique and every problem that they've got is unique.
To a point. Well, the ones that we enjoy working on, for sure.
Well, yes. And again, this is sort of another part of the sales approach that I kind of work towards. It's like trying to explain to people what we do when we implement enterprise software, which is a term that most people outside, like I said earlier, most people outside the industry have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I like to say, you know, it's the processes and the things that make each business unique. It's each business's personal secret sauce that makes them stand out from their competition. It's their IP that takes them above and beyond those around them, right? It's what makes them different. That's what differentiates them from their competitors.
Yep.
Right. And in that respect, yes, it is. The software we're writing is unique. Now, sometimes we're doing software that's able to be white labeled or unsold.
Yeah.
Right. We might be working in that space. That's a bit different. But, you know, most of the time, if I'm doing something for a customer, for an enterprise customer, yeah, it's a thing that means that if they're going to spend money with me, it's because they're getting benefits that their competition don't have.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a whole other conversation. And it's one that we've been intending to talk about for a while. But there's an element of the Pareto principle here, which is that 80% of what we do in 80% of these client projects is similar enough that, you know, we should be able to template it, reuse it, what have you. All right. But of course, the 80% of the value is in that 20%, and 80% of the interesting and complex projects is the outlier of 20% of projects.
Absolutely.
If that makes sense. Yeah. So and that's where that value is, and that's the unique part, and that's the bit that's different, and that's the bit that encapsulates the uniqueness of every individual business.
Mm.
But you know, interestingly enough, you know, enterprise software, you know, I always say that every enterprise application is basically a database and forms and lists. But then the thing that I was speaking about that I did last week was, and I said they were trying to wrap a way of interacting with this record system around it that was in a way that of not doing that, basically, which was quite interesting.
No, I agree. I think you're right. Like, I would say, yeah, it's that 80-20 rule again. 80% of the enterprise stuff we do work on is, you know, as I think, as Yuli's says in the past, it's forms over data.
Yep.
Right? It's just data entry, database. But there's that extra 20% of those applications, which is, again, the secret sauce. It's your domain model. It's
all of those applications, even the ones that are just forms over data, like there is that 20% of even those ones, 20% of that application is the secret sauce.
Yep.
It's not that 20% of the applications that we work on are secret sauce applications.
applications. All of them are, even the ones where like 80% of it is just forms over data. Although I think forms, I think lists as well, forms and lists, but
yeah,
that's nitpicking.
Well, that's it. This has been a meandering conversation, Matt.
It has. I think it has.
We started out wanting to talk about problem solving.
Indeed.
We've gone through to domain-driven design, requirements gathering, getting back to first principles. Definitely didn't see this one going this way.
No. I mean, where I was trying to get at was that what I'm learning more of is that the art of problem solving, and this really ties into kind of something that we spoke about with Scott Arbeit about grace as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about problem solving, 9 times out of 10, I reckon, it's about identifying that the problem actually doesn't need to be solved and that there's a better way. It's like, you know, using that example of a set about how to reconcile the conflict between this one system and the other. How do I create an or between these two policies? There was another example we spoke about, but in essence, it's, you know, it's that the problem doesn't exist. You don't, it's edge cases. Don't solve that problem. Don't worry about it. You don't need to solve that problem. It's not a problem. That's kind of what I was trying to get at.
Yeah. And when it is a problem, then the solution will almost just show itself.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, you know, I've created a bit of a problem for myself this evening, Liam.
What's that?
My glass is empty.
Mine is too. So you mentioned earlier you were actually drinking that stout that you've been teasing us for the last 2 years.
That's right. So
not quite 2 years, because we're only just coming up to our 1 year anniversary.
Wow, that's right. Yeah. Wow. So our next episode will be our anniversary. It will be our final. It will be our
26th episode.
Which marks a year. Wow.
Yes. Sounds like a retro's on the card.
It does. Yeah, it does. So this, I've been drinking the Supersonic Imperial Stout. I don't know if I've told you before, but Supersonic is the name of the brand of the beer that I brew.
No, I did not know that you had your own brand.
Well, I mean, I don't. It's just the name that I call it. Because when I first started brewing this time around, I lived in Concord, so I call it Supersonic.
And that's the one that you've said has been sitting down for 2 years?
Yeah, yeah. So I think I brewed it about 2 years ago. This particular one has been in the fridge since the last time I tried it, so it won't have aged at all.
Yeah.
But it's still good. I must have about 40-odd bottles of it sitting in the garage, so I should bring some of those in, stick them in the fridge.
Yep.
It's actually quite good. It's very sweet. It's a lot sweeter than I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
But it's very potable.
Yeah. So, I mean, today I was just drinking the same Balta Cerveza that I had last time. That's the last one from this case. But I wanted to say a little, I guess, a shout out, right? You said that the brand that you brew under is called Supersonic.
Yeah.
So was it not last week? The week before last, a friend of ours, and a friend like through my kid's school, a friend of ours, he just launched his own brand, his own beer brand.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty cool. They're now distributed nationally through BWS and Dan Murphy's. I mean, it's great.
Do a shameless plug.
It's called First Hand Brewing.
Yep.
So he's originally from the Griffith area, and his co-founder's Indigenous. So they've got sort of that, I guess that's where the name First Hand came from. And the cans they're an orange can, and they've got the Aboriginal artwork that his co-founder designed. I had one, was it last night? Last night I had a six pack. They clearly went before I had a chance here, so I can't show you again. And look, they're a good beer. Look, yes, they're a friend of ours. I'm not gonna say they're a terrible beer, but no, honestly, they're an easy drinking beer. They're a good session lager that you can just get through easily. But absolutely, have a look. Dan Murphy's BWS Australia Wine.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Yeah, I'll put that on the list.
Yeah.
But maybe go ahead.
I was going to say just one more little shameless plug. a guy that I used to work with, and I believe it might have been when I was used to work with Matt Wicks a while back. He's recently started this, I guess it's like a meetup of sorts, called Dadland.
Oh, yes.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have it open on my tab here and I keep meaning to tell Yuli about it as well.
Yeah. And the only reason I want to bring that up, like I've seen him doing it on LinkedIn, like he's been posting it on LinkedIn for the last, whatever it is, 12 months or so.
Yeah.
But I only wanted to say something because it was an article about it in the on the ABC website, ABC News website.
Wow.
Which I thought was pretty awesome.
Yeah. So I've had my eye on that for ages, and I really need to tell Yuli about this. But they meet up at on the Central Coast.
Yep.
So yeah, it's been on my radar for a while. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and I think they're now Australia wide too.
So I'm looking at their website now, and they've got Coffs Harbour, Hobart, Gold Coast, Brisbane, Melbourne, Fraser Coast, Adelaide, Sydney, online only, Bundaberg, Perth, Canberra, Wollongong, and Central Coast.
Mm.
And you can sign up to host your own if you want.
Yeah. So
should we tell people what it is?
I think the name says it all, right?
I think so, yeah.
I think it's a great. It's just look, I guess again, back when I was at high school, you know, we used to have the impromptu LAN parties.
Yeah.
Not that I was a big gamer, or not that I am back then, but yeah, you know, we'd go around to one of the mates' places, everyone would lug around their big PC cases and big CRTs.
Hook them up.
Who had the biggest CRT?
Yeah. Hook them up with your coax cable.
No, they were Ethernet, but you know, at that point, no one really understood networking. So you're all trying to figure out what IP addresses are and
right.
And you know, again, going back to first principles, understanding what numbers you can put in there and which ones were the right numbers and why it worked and trying to figure all that stuff out. But yeah, I mean, it's, I guess, back to the topic at hand, the Dadland's all about just getting dads back into that environment. And I think actually, now I'm just spitballing here, but maybe we should have William on the podcast.
Why not? Yeah.
Have a chat about it. I can go and reach out.
But not for the next one, because for the next one, Liam, we should see if we can get together and have a beer.
I'm just looking at my calendar right now.
Now, we may, there's one small caveat around that, which is that you're going to have to come up here because
yes,
I can't stray too far from home at the moment.
Look, Matt, I think we can arrange for something along those lines. I'm looking forward to digging into one of those stouts. Make sure you get them in the fridge.
I'll get some in the fridge for sure. Yeah. And I also have a Clone and Wood on tap.
Awesome.
So there's plenty to go around.
Awesome. I might bring up a six pack of first hand too.
All right. We're doing it.
Sounds good.
I might have to take the following day off work.
Yeah, well, I'll still need to drive home.
Right, okay, yeah.
We'll figure something out.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I still have a lot to do to learn about solving problems, I think.
But, I think we all do. I think we all do. Oh, I've got a lot of problems that I can't solve right now.
I do too, but I think we've dived enough into solving problems this evening. We've been meandering and rambling quite a lot, and I'm looking forward to catching up for a beer next time, but I think for this time, that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Well, exactly, right?
Hey, what's the subtitle of the book? Main Driven Design. Oh, almost fell off my seat.